Welcome to the Hospital Finance Podcast, your go-to source for information and insights that can help you protect and enhance revenue at your hospital. And now, the host of the Hospital Finance Podcast, Michael Passanante.
Hi, this is Mike Passanante, and welcome back to the Hospital Finance Podcast. Today, I'm joined by John Dalton. John is a senior advisor emeritus here at Bessler Consulting, who is back to discuss part three of his series, American Healthcare, Worst Value in the Developed World. John recently completed 13 years on the Board of Trustees of the St. Joseph's Healthcare System, where he chaired the Strategic Planning Committee. He serves as honorary trustee at Children's Specialized Hospital, where he is a former board chair, and most recently was named by the New Jersey Hospital Association as its 2017 Hospital Trustee of the Year. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Mike. Nice to be here.
John, in part two of the series, we looked at data from France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, which provided us with some clues about how their approaches produce better quality healthcare at lower cost than the U.S. Let's start out. Which of their approaches produces the best results, and are there lessons we can glean from all three?
Yes, as you know from the earlier part of the series, France uses the two-tier system as an approach to universal health care. Germany, the insurance mandate, sort of what we have in the Affordable Care Act, and the UK is a single-payer system. When we looked at all of the data about their approaches, we found that the single-payer countries produce the best results. And whether you love them or hate them, the senator from Vermont was right. Single-payer produces the best results. And among the single-payer countries, the Brits do it best. Single-payer is not likely to happen here in the U.S. Because it's highly reliant on taxation for funding. But interestingly, we already have two single-payer systems here in the U.S. That's both the Veterans Administration and the Indian Health Service. Those are single-payer systems. Are there outcomes available that will produce better are there options available that will produce better outcomes and help start to help us close the gap with the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development countries? I think so. There's some elements that we can apply from France, Germany, and the United Kingdom to help us achieve the triple aim. Okay, there are a lot of lessons that we can learn from our colleagues in the United Kingdom, France, and Germany. But first, let's also look at some of the issues we've already tackled and how they compare to what France, Germany, and UK do. You heard earlier about the frustration in France and Germany with unlimited freedom of choice. Well, unfortunately, ever since the HMO movement started in the 1980s, we Americans have had to learn how to live with limited freedom of choice and narrow networks. So that's one issue that they have that we've already tackled. The common elements, we already have many of Americans who receive health care coverage through their employer, just as in France and in Germany. The Affordable Care Act did include an insurance mandate, as in the Germans do, but it was a watered-down one. So one of the key issues facing us now is that only 28% of the 18 to 34-year-old demographic actually are in the risk pool. So that's one of the reasons why there's been instability with the insurance exchanges. We already have an essential health benefits package mandated through the Affordable Care Act. That includes doctor services, inpatient and outpatient hospital care, prescription drug coverage, pregnancy and childbirth, mental health and rehabilitation services. So we already have that in common with France, Germany, and the UK. What could we learn or adapt from those three countries? Well, I put together a list of seven starters that I think are worth debating and hopefully will be part of the ongoing debate as something replaces the Affordable Care Act. One, as a country, we need to move even more aggressively to get to full interoperability to reduce the administrative costs. The French got there in 1998, the Germans in 2008. We could emulate the French approach of a mandated core benefits package and allow the opportunity to purchase supplemental insurance for expanded coverage. That's an approach that I think would work well in America. Or look at Germany's employer-based insurance mandate and couple that with competition among not-for-profit insurers for base coverage. We could either copy France's patient payment and time of service approach, and as someone who spent his career in the revenue cycle, that's appealing to me, or Germany's patient co-payment approach, one or the other. From all three countries, we need to maintain primary care providers as private practitioners. I think that's part of the reason for their success. Unfortunately, in the U.S., we have only 35% of our primary care providers, 65% are specialists. It's the reverse in those countries. We need to provide incentives for medical students to select primary care. For example, forgiveness of student loan debt over 15 to 20 years to correct that current imbalance. We've already on our way to doing that. There are several programs. Texas Tech University has one at their medical school that make sure that medical students who select primary care will have their student loan debt repaid. But finally, the seventh one is the toughest one. We need to encourage our not-for-profit healthcare leaders to engage more closely with social services providers in the communities that they serve.
John, your seven starters are thought-provoking, and I think well worth debating. How do you think they'll be received inside the Beltway?
Well, that's when things start to get tangled up in competing interests and conflicting priorities and the K Street lobbyists hitting congressmen and senators. We've seen a lot of that through the course of this year. As you know, in July, the Department of Justice filed suit to block the proposed Anthem, Cigna, and Aetna Humana mergers, contending that, quote, they would leave the multi-trillion health insurance industry in the hands of three mammoth insurance companies. Well, Aetna, as you know, responded with the corporate equivalent of a hissy fit, eliminating its Affordable Care Act coverage in 11 states, claiming that they had $430 million in losses since January 2014. So you've got that force. On the other hand, I take heart from folks like Bernie Tyson, CEO of $61 billion Kaiser Permanente, a not-for-profit provider. He's sticking with the exchanges long-term. And here's his quote. I view it through the lens of my mission. It obligates us to figure it out, not to get out. He further noted that the market is unstable given adverse selection and underpricing by some plans to capture market share. And, end quote. Over time, it's going to work itself out. This is not rocket science, unquote. So Tyson seems to have a pretty clear view of how this can be made to work. Then we have Big Pharma. There's been a lot of press over the last year about drug pricing. The EpiPen has been around since 1977, but Mylan Pharmaceuticals acquired the auto-injector in 2007 when they were selling for $57 each. EpiPens now cost more than $600 for a two-pack, and people who suffer from anaphylaxis, as does one of my granddaughters, need to keep them handy at all times. Turing Pharmaceutical, Martin Shkreli, the most hated man in America, brought Daraprim in 2015. They raised the price from $13.50 a pill to $750 a pill. Now, Daraprim is the only cure for toxoplasmosis. That's a disease that strikes people whose immune systems are suppressed or compromised. Examples would be AIDS patients and cancer patients. Then there's Valeant Pharmaceuticals, Canadian-based, although very active in the United States. They boosted the price of the diabetes drug, Glumetza, by about 800% in 2015. They also acquired Carrot Cream in 2011 that's used for cancer skin conditions. That rose by 1,700% in 6 years. To our government's credit, all three CEOs have been hauled before Congress for congressional flogging, but still the drug prices are escalating at an unbelievable rate here in the U.S., and something's got to be done about it.
So, John, looking at the seven starters and some of the elements you've just discussed, where do you think Democrats and Republicans inside the Beltway can come together?
Well, as we know, we had a very divisive presidential election with clearly polar opposites in terms of health policy. We had Secretary Clinton espousing expand and embrace the Affordable Care Act, and President Trump advocating let's repeal and replace it with something terrific. But looking at the two platforms post-election, I looked at them to see where there might be some common ground. What are non-starters? Well, clearly, when you look at Secretary Clinton's platform, she was advocating universal, quality, affordable health care for everyone in America, which would include undocumented aliens. Clearly, that's a non-starter. She wanted to allow families to buy health insurance on the health exchanges regardless of their immigration status. Clearly, a non-starter. Her platform also talked about defending access to reproductive health care and doubling funding for community health centers, probably non-starters. On the Republican platform, number one priority was to completely repeal Obamacare and replace it. Some of the other issues raised there were to allow sale of health insurance across state lines. That's been in Republican platforms for a number of years, but has a very lukewarm response from the big five insurance carriers, so that's not likely to happen. Also talked about allowing individuals to deduct health insurance premium payments from their tax returns and using health savings accounts and to accumulate unused portion as part of the individual's estate, and requiring price transparency from all providers. Ideas worth debating. Looking at both platforms, there are some areas of common concern. President Trump's, the Republican platform, talked about removing barriers to entry into free markets for drug providers that offer safe, reliable, and cheaper products. And believe me, I'd much rather buy my Crestor from Canada than have to pay for $350 for a 90-day supply here in the U.S. On the Democratic platform, there were three items that dealt with drug costs. One was to bring down the out-of-pocket costs, reduce the cost of prescription drugs, and protect consumers from unjustified prescription drug price increases. So I think one area for the battle inside the Beltway will be to identify Big Pharma as a common enemy and attack that. That should be very popular with President Trump's voting base. Secretary Clinton's, the Democratic platform, also talked about expanding access to rural Americans who often have difficulty finding quality, affordable health care. And as we know, critical access hospitals struggle consistently. Well, that should be very appealing to the president's voting base. That's something that I think both Democrats and Republicans can agree on tackling. In terms of the health savings account issue and the health insurance premium payments deductibility, there is an intent for comprehensive reform of the tax code. So those probably will roll into the debate. I find those interesting and intriguing and worth debating. But my question on those is how they will play out for the folks who are employed at Walmart and McDonald's. We've seen the experience with folks opting into 401ks, and now we have a whole generation heading for retirement with inadequate retirement savings. I fear that the same kind of problem would affect them on those two proposals. But we'll have to see how it goes. Even if on January 21st the Affordable Care Act is repealed with a two-year replacement period, I think when we get down into the weeds, there are so many pieces of it that are necessary in any health reform legislation that'll bog down in some process in both the House and the Senate. Yeah, we'll know a lot more come February or March. We just learned today that Dr. Tom Price, Republican representative from Georgia, will be nominated as the next HHS secretary. He's an orthopedic surgeon. Some of his proposals include allowing folks to opt out of Medicare and Medicaid for tax credits, but where will he be in terms of things like the Comprehensive Joint Replacement Program, and the like? When we look at the Affordable Care Act, we've already heard that the provision that allows kids to stay on their parents' policy until age 26 will stay, and that we will continue to have guaranteed issuance, no pre-existing conditions. There are other provisions that I think, as the debate goes forward, will wind up being carried forward as part of whatever reform takes place. I don't think anybody wants to go back to the days when insurance carriers could spend more than 15 cents out of every dollar on administrative expenses. Now that we know that France, Germany, and the UK spend less than 5 cents out of every dollar on administrative expenses. The 31 states that have benefited from Medicaid expansion already are making noises that they want to retain that. It's worked well in their states. Many of them have Republican governors, as we do here in New Jersey, and we know that Governor Christie is in favor of continuing the Medicaid expansion. So those are areas that will be debated. We're certainly not going to revoke the patient protection provisions that have already improved quality with significant reductions in both central line associated bloodstream infections and surgical site infections over the last several years. So I think a lot of what is contained down in the weeds is going to be retained. Hopefully what issues out of this will something that includes all American citizens at a reasonable cost.
So there's going to be continued battles inside the Beltway for some time to come on the nuances of healthcare policy. But John, what can those of us involved in not-for-profit healthcare do to advance the seven starters that you mentioned, engaging more closely with social services providers in the communities that they serve?
Well, the good news is a lot of that work already has begun. There was an article in the May 2016 issue of Health Affairs that talked about variation in health outcomes, and it did a deeper dive into the role of spending on social services, public health, and healthcare, and looked at the first decade of the 21st century, 2000 to 2009. And even in that period, it found that states that have a higher ratio of social to health spending had significantly better subsequent health outcomes for adult obesity, asthma, mentally unhealthy days, days with activity limitations, and mortality rates for lung cancer, AMIs, and type 2 diabetes. The article also pointed out that many of the states with those higher ratios were in the West, while those with less healthy spending patterns were in the South. So the western part of the U.S. is already ahead of the curve on that. In reviewing 74 research studies, the article reported that three types of services are particularly meaningful: supportive housing, nutritional support, that includes Meals on Wheels and WIC supplemental nutritional services, and certain case management and outreach programs. And they concluded, and I quote, "Broadening the debate beyond what should be spent on healthcare to include what should be invested in health, not only in healthcare, but also in social services and public health, is warranted," end quote. Here in our area, we've already started. Organizations like the Mount Sinai Health System, New York Presbyterian, have major initiatives going forward on population health and community involvement. A couple of quotes from Dr. Kenneth Davis, who's CEO of Mount Sinai, illustrate both the success and the problem. Here's Dr. Davis, quote, "If a patient attributed to us has diabetes and we keep that person out of the hospital, we are rewarded in a population health model. But if we invest in preventing community residents from ever getting diabetes in the first place, we're paid nothing extra. Even under the most advanced population health models, there is no way to get paid for improving the long-term health status of the community. Nonetheless, Mount Sinai is going forward with some of these initiatives and is at risk for doing so." Dr. Steve Corwin, CEO of New York Presbyterian, they have a major initiative going forward in Washington Heights on population health for about 250,000 folks in that population, as well as throughout their healthcare system. Here's Dr. Corwin, quote, "If you visit the home of an asthmatic child and you remove mold and allergens from that home, it dramatically reduces that child's likelihood of coming into the emergency room," end quote. So I tend to be a cockeyed optimist, even though I've been advocating for universal health care for almost 40 years now and still far from achieving it. I think that the not-for-profit leadership of our major health systems are going to continue to move us forward at an appropriate pace to achieve that triple aim. It means we have to go beyond our comfort zones. We already in healthcare excel at diagnosing, treating, and curing the patients who receive care in our hospitals. But improving the health of the population in our service areas does require us to reach out into the community services, social services safety net, in order to foster better health habits among consumers, something over which providers have little or no control currently. I take heart from examples like the Geisinger Health System in Danville, Pennsylvania, who've been into population health very deeply for a number of years. Part of their success is attributable to the fact that they own a health plan. They have a very large multi-specialty physician practice and the healthcare system. So they've got the three pieces working together. But even there, they will tell you that it took several years to be able to change consumer behavior. And the key to that, in many instances, was placing nurses in doctors' offices, nurses funded not by the health system, but by the health plan. There are many, many other examples out there like Geisinger that we need to emulate. I believe that hospitals that succeed in providing better care while fostering healthy behaviors in the communities they serve will lower the per capita costs of care and produce better outcomes on the key health indicators and begin to help us close the gap with the rest of the developed world. Thanks, Mike.
Well, John, the triple aim is certainly an objective worth striving for and helping to reduce the gap between the U.S. and the rest of the world when it comes to quality of healthcare. So thanks for enlightening us and providing this most thought-provoking series.
You're quite welcome, Mike.
If you enjoy the Hospital Finance Podcast, please head up to iTunes to subscribe and leave us a positive review.
This concludes today's episode of the Hospital Finance Podcast. For show notes and additional resources to help you protect and enhance revenue at your hospital, visit Bessler.com/podcasts. The Hospital Finance Podcast is a production of Bessler Consulting.